Hi there, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Cloud-Based Mayhem. I had a really fun one for you today with Tom Pagini. He's a legendary pilot and has been in aviation his entire life. He started hang gliding in 1969. You have that right. As a young pup, he was the youngest person to compete in the first U.S. Nationals in 73 out in California. And the youngest person to ever compete in the first Worlds in Kosin in 1975. So we, of course, dive into all his history there and his background in designing wings and the first Kestrel and two-surface and a lot of names and just a ton of really fun history here. He's recently, in the last few years, gotten into paragliding. He's as passionate today as he's ever been, he says. And this was just a ball. I got interested in Tom and talking to Tom and a lot of the others, Roy Haggard and John Heine and a bunch of other shows we're going to have shortly, because Hugh Miller at XE Mag reached out a couple months ago and suggested we start doing shows on the, you know, on the legends and getting people from each of the various decades on the show. And so we're kicking it off with Tom, because his quote that Hugh Miller shared with me was, "In comparison, the rest of my life has been a disappointment." And I thought, oh man, that is awesome. So, and Hugh also put me on to The Big Blue Sky, which guides a lot of this talk. The Big Blue Sky is a wonderful film with amazing archive footage of the beginnings of hang gliding. And Tom is in that quite a bit, along with all the other legends. And then as they start to learn how to not just take little quick glides down little hills, they start learning how to thermal and get up tall. And then that's when the carnage hits, and it's all pretty fascinating stuff. But Tom has been, like I said, in aviation his entire life. He's worked in the ultralight industry for a long time, but still a very passionate pilot today. He lives out in the Northeast, and he's chasing it pretty hard. So enjoy this talk with a very interesting, fascinating individual who's been doing it an awfully long time. Cheers. Tom, welcome to the Mayhem. I really appreciate you reaching out and forcing this a little bit to happen, because I was trying to get out to talk to Roy and John and those guys out in California, but we'll do it piece by piece. I've just really enjoyed all the things you sent to me yesterday, your CV and bio, which are incredibly intimidating, to tell you the truth. You've done a lot, but we have to start at the beginning, which is a long time back. 1969. 13 years old is when you got into this game.
Well, hi, Gavin. It's when we first started. Yes, I had started an aviation club in eighth grade, and in with my metal shop teacher, Mr. Baldwin. We were going to build a Volksplane, and he got us involved with the EAA, the Experimental Aircraft Association, and we did go to some of their local meetings in people's basements and things. But it was still kind of out of reach for, you know, someone that age. And in the back of Sport Aviation magazine, there was a little tiny ad in, you know, right at the classifieds, practically in the back, for batwing plans. And it was Jim Foreman from Amarillo, Texas, and they were $5. And so we sent away for that. We went, wow, look at that thing. And it was actually a set of plans from Richard Miller's Bamboo Butterflies, what he called it, which was a very early use of a Regalo wing. And he was a very kind of a real minimalist person. And so it was made out of bamboo and polyethylene plastic with a new miracle material, fiberglass tape, because it just, you know, just became popular at that time. So it was literally, you know, they were literally, and people did this quite a bit around the United States and the world, built the first real hang gliders to, you know, popular hang gliders out of bamboo and plastic.
I love, you know, you're not the first person I've spoken with. You know, Miguel down in Mexico, who's been running the Monarca forever, invited Bravo. He comes from a big family of aviation. You guys all talk about this, these plans, this $5 plan, you know, and it was happening in Europe. It was happening in Mexico. It's just really cool that there was this kind of shared, I'm sure you guys didn't even know of other communities, right? I mean, in the beginning, it was kind of happening. There was just, you know, all these people around the world that wanted to be birds. It didn't start with Da Vinci, did it?
No, it didn't. And actually, you know, hang gliding goes back to Otto Lilienthal, of course, the inventor of flight. He didn't invent the airplane, but he invented flight in my book. But I consider Richard Miller to be, you know, the patron saint guru of modern free flight, if you will, because some of the things he did were right at the core of everything that kind of came out from it. And it did for me, you know, personally.
And that was his interpretation of Regalo's designs. Was that why, or?
Yes. And so there was someone prior to that, Barry Palmer.
Yeah.
That had flown up in Northern California.
Even on my list here.
even earlier on, you know, and had some fantastic flights from some of the hills up in Northern California where they have no trees and things, and, you know, going way up on the hill and, you know, 3-minute flights and way higher than, you know, he cared to fall. That was the rule back in the don't fly higher than you care to fall. It was the original rule of hang gliding. But Richard Miller, he kind of pushed the concept of self-flight, and Joe Faust kind of picked up that torch later. But he was also the editor of Soaring Magazine and a writer. And I wrote about this on Facebook recently. If you haven't read, it's kind of a kooky book, Without Visible Means of Support, is a book by Richard Miller that you can still find on eBay, I think. And it's worth seeing. And he's got his Regalo on the cover, I think, and it's Photoshop. Well, it wasn't Photoshop back then, but it was graphically put, his Regalo wings put on the cover. And I think it's a shot from the Vasa Coupe during the 20s, the early glider flights they had there on the cover.
You know, that film that Hugh put me on to, but you and I discussed it in the emails leading up to this, the Big Blue Sky, which is just phenomenal. There's so much cool footage that, you know, from the original footage of the comps you guys were going to early on, and the Stoke. When you say Miller's original Regalo design, is this the kind of Sweeney biplane type of thing? I think a Regalo is more the parachute.
No, it was literally a Regalo biplane, except instead of wires and a king post or aluminum tubes, he built the compression and lift structure out of a Warren truss of bamboo. I'll send you a picture after this. And we built one. So
similar to what Sweeney was flying in his
Sweeney, Terry Sweeney, another, we'll get back to more. He's going to come up over and over again if we talk about the old days for me. He built what was called the Chanute biplane. And just after Otto Lilienthal had been doing his flying in the Berlin area, Octave Chanute was a civil engineer in the United States that actually influenced the Wright brothers to use a box kite structure, you know, with vertical tubes and X bracing for the structure. And he did some very interesting flights out on the dunes of Lake Michigan. And he was before the Wright brothers and after Lilienthal, but both Lilienthal and Chanute influenced the Wright brothers.
We're so spoiled these days. I mean, when I watch the Big Blue Sky and just the happiness and joy of a 3 to 20 second flight, and the work that must have been involved getting it back up the hill and all the people and this kind of thing. I mean, we wouldn't walk out the door to do that these days, you know?
No.
It's incredible. But if
you take it out of context, you know, the first few flights that I tried to do were very parachutal, you know,
yeah.
As you go kind of wee and you're scared and you don't run hard enough. Even Terry talks about that in his,
sure.
In his first, you know, flight. But yeah, I remember the first time that in the white kite that I sent you a picture of, hang tube Brugalo, got up on a hill big enough. The wind was finally right. I finally had the nerve to do it, accelerated enough to really get the thing on, you know, on plane and gliding and going, whoa. When, you know, we landed, because there was no one there telling you what to expect. There was sure. Nobody knew what to expect. No, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't know whether I was going to fly and land in the run out. We were on a steep ski slope hill with no run out, you know, at the bottom perch. I didn't know if I was going to fly off into the wires at the bottom or the trees after the ski hut and just the whole experience. Yeah, it was, you know, transcendent, really, if you look back at it.
Oh, imagine. I mean, it's kind of wild to think too. My neighbor and mentor forever, Nate Scales, you know, he competed in the X Alps in 2007, but his first flight here was 89, 90, I want to say, on a paraglider. So he had done some hang gliding, but his first paraglider, he walked into a ski shop and there was a guy in the ski shop said, "Hey, anybody here want to go paragliding? I just got one," you know? And so Nate said, "Yeah, I want to do that." And he took him out to the hill and they hiked up and Nate flew off and he came down to the LZ, you know, the bottom of the hill. And the guy said, "Okay, well, now you know as much as I do." You know, and he was the instructor, but
yeah, right.
It's yeah. Just, you know, here, have a go, see what happens. And that was, you know, 20 something years after you guys got into it, you know, it was amazing. And that obviously, you know, at this point, Larry's flying a couple hundred miles. You guys are all been, right. I mean, you knew a lot about flight at that point, but it's amazing that, you know, it kind of went through the same trajectory with paragliding early on. Nobody really knew anything.
One of the things that helped me very early on was that I had been flying models all my life.
Yeah.
And I started flying U-control models with my dad when I was about 6, you know, the ones you fly around in a circle with a little 2-stroke motor on it, a little glow plug engine. And then we graduated into RC, radio control, very early RC stuff. For some reason, we were both really interested in gliders. So I started flying RC gliders very early on. And so that really helped me a lot later. Not much later, maybe a year or so later in life, starting to fly hang gliders. I knew about wind and stalls and reflex and weight and balance.
And this is a common thing I've heard. I don't have any background with RC, but there a lot of the really good pilots I've had on the show over the years got their start in RC. There must be a lot of knowledge buried in there and intrinsically to just understand what air is doing. I mean, I always think about that with kayaking and the transfer over to flying, sailing, kite surfing. You know, you're using these invisible elements that help you understand lee and eddies and flow.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
But you were talking with Caliph Letourneau,
yeah.
On a really good, and wow, what a well spoken guy he is.
He is
talking,
yeah,
about things.
Very articulate.
But anyway, I had always tried to explain to people, particularly early on, I was this little kid, you know, and everybody else I was flying with was older than me. And I tried to explain to them, yeah, don't fly back there. Mm. You have to imagine it like, you ever see white water? It's white water air back there. Mm. You know, you don't want any part of that kind of. So,
you understand,
so yeah,
it.
The visualization's the same. Well, it's the same. The visualization, the fluid dynamics of it. We're all viscously involved. You know, one way or another.
I'm interested, you know, in the Big Blue Sky and watching all you guys and all that original footage and the, you know, there's this whole, the whole segment of the film early on is these little quick, you know, learning how to deal with wind and you're barely getting off the ground and you're having these little flights and it seemed from the film things start progressing pretty quickly. But in your, you know, in 1969, when you're doing that in 1970 and 71, before you go to your first nationals event when you're 17, was it on your radar already that, oh, once we make these better, we're going to be going thousands of feet off the ground because of the RC? Or was that in anybody's mind yet that we're going to be flying big distances? Or was that still, that hadn't formulated?
No, it was so fantastic to think of that. Mm. It hadn't. I was still waiting, you know, for quite a while to get my first soaring flight in at all. And it was slope soaring on a dune out at Cape Cod. So no, I had no idea in the concept of people going up on the top of, you know, giant mountains and flying off hadn't. Huh. Bill Liskam did a great job on that film.
Amazing.
Putting it into historical context too was really good. Instead of it just being all about the flying, I thought he really set the stage for what was going on at the time.
And do I also have it right that, and if I'm jumping ahead,
that's
keep
fine,
pulling me back. But do I also have it right that it seemed like, at least the way the film was structured, and those of you who are listening, you haven't seen this, just Google it. It's The Big Blue Sky. It is unbelievable. It's awesome. But there's, you know, it seemed like when flight remained, you know, close to the ground and, you know, maybe a little bit of soaring, but mostly just these little quick flights, it was, I mean, it looked still kind of hairy, but it seemed like the carnage, there wasn't that much carnage. It wasn't until they started going up and started using thermals. And then it seemed like it went through this really horrible period. Was that right?
No, that's correct. Yeah, that's really correct.
Okay.
In fact, we went for a long time without anyone buying it. And Lloyd Leicher, who started Yushka at the time, which is now Yushpa.
Yeah.
And originally it was a Southern California Hang Gliding Association. It was SCHGA. That's when I joined. Mm-hmm. He actually left the, he was the director of the Soaring Association. And he felt he wanted to bring hang gliding into the Soaring Association because he felt there was so much knowledge in there that they could, you know, give to the hang gliding community to try to help us get through that first part. Mm. There was a lot of learning. But also, since it was totally unregulated, people were doing whatever they wanted to.
Yeah.
And there's no one there, no club structure, no Yushpa, you know, para ratings, no nothing. So you could just buy one of these things in a kit, bolt it together, go wherever you want. I'm going up on that biggest mountain and I don't care what the wind does, you know.
Everything was just predicated on balls.
Like. And wits, maybe.
Yeah.
Or lack of.
Yeah. Wow. Was there, I'm always reminded that, you know, sailplanes had been around for a while at this stage. You know, they'd been doing cross country for a bunch of years. Was there much crossover and reaching out to that community? Was there much, a subject that's come up again and again is, why don't we treat our sports, hang gliding and paragliding, more like sailplanes? Why don't we learn from them because they've done it longer? You know, they treat it more like commercial aviation checklists, and it's more, I wouldn't say regulated, but I would say more, you're following a set of rules more stringently. It's not so
cowboy. Rules based.
Yeah. Yep.
The you know, all the free flight could still benefit greatly from a little bit more of that. I wish I had a wrist checklist, you know, before I took off or on my knee or something.
Yeah.
You know, it would be, although I kind of like not having that, and I really don't like using radios, you know, but it's all part of it.
I think of my own kind of trajectory in flying. And one of the things I was so impressed in reading your bio and your resume and what you've done is you know, you started flying hang gliders at 13, you go out, you're the youngest participant ever in the first U.S. Nationals out in California, and you're 17. How the hell did you survive? And at that age, I mean, if I had gotten into this sport when I was that age and that stupid. You know, I mean, I was a ski racer growing up, and all I wanted was just speed. I didn't care whatsoever about my body. I was unbreakable. I was invincible. I was, you know, you're young. How did you survive?
I think there's two things. First of all, I whaled myself a bunch when I was a little kid. I would always, you know, like move real fast and then fall over a railing or something and break my arm. So I got a little bit out of that out of my system. And secondly, my dad chuckled about it. Dad and I, my father, Jim, we would call when you really smash a RC, it re-kitted itself. It turned back into a kit, you know.
Right. And so gotta rebuild it.
I saw a bunch of that and I wanted no part of it.
I just knew. You had the respect for it even early on.
Yes. Yes, I really did. I was a scaredy cat. And it didn't stop me from doing it, but it really gave me pause. And it's still a problem I have these days, even, you know, to this day. And then being a test pilot pretty much all my life, the combination of the two.
Yeah, we will. Well, we got a lot to talk about in terms of your ultralight and business and you know, aviation endeavors after hang gliding and that kind of thing. But I know you've maintained hang gliding throughout your career and more recently in paragliding. But I'd love to hear about this trip to Kosin, your first Worlds. I think you were also the youngest at the Worlds, right?
Yes.
That's an amazing part of the world.
It's an amazing part of the world. And to go there, you had asked me a question. First of all, how did I live through all this stuff too? I want to say that right from the beginning, there are some really nice older folks that kind of took me under their wing. We started the company at Sky Sports. There was a man named Dan Pointer who had written the parachute manual. Ted Strong, who was very big in the sport of skydiving. The development of it. Mike Markowski, who's a very early hang gliding persona and designer. And then a guy named Ed Vickery. And Ed Vickery is the man who ended up taking over Sky Sports. And I went and worked with him. He was the first one to take a Papillon, which was the parasailing thing, and jump it. You know, they had a glide ratio and stuff, and he saw the possibilities of the development of hang gliding and really wanted to go all in on it. And he kind of took me under his wing too and sponsored me originally. I became the test pilot, then the designer for the company, and he paid for me to go out to the Annie Green Springs Nationals, which was the first nationals out at Sylmar, and then he also paid for me to go to the first world championships in Kosin. And so I went over there on my own, packed my glider up, took it to Logan Airport in Boston, over to the freight terminal, then went over, got on an airplane by myself and flew to Europe with, you know, we had travel agents back then that would organize a lot of things. But got out of the plane, you know, picked up my glider. How am I going to get it to the train? You know, carried my glider to the train, got it on a train, got it on a bus.
And this is 76, right?
1974. Yeah.
What does your flight deck look like at the Worlds in 74?
Well, back there was a man named Irv. Mr. Culver, Matt Culver's dad, I forget his first name. Sorry. I think he was USHPA number one, by the way.
Wow.
Or USHGA, or Southern California Hang Gliding Association, number one. And
you're, what did you, you sent me your number. Well, you're 200 something.
262. Bill Liscombe, the, you know, the man who made Big Blue Sky, his number's lower. So I always have to buy the first beer.
I'm 85179. That's, I don't have much to brag about. That's amazing too.
So anyway, he made one of the first commercially available hang gliding variometers. And that was the flight deck.
Wow.
the Wills guys, originally Bob Wills and Chris Wills, they used instruments too. And Pat Canary, who was a very early, very advanced hang glider pilot, had the company Ball Aerospace started with variometers for sailplanes and things. And they had those too.
So your dad kind of got you into aviation, or you guys were flying RCs together and stuff. What is he thinking at this point? You're getting on a plane by yourself to go to coast. And is he thinking, Jesus, what did I do here? Or is he psyched?
No, both my parents, I grew up in a very open household. We had people coming in and out all the time. It was a big old house. I have two sisters and a brother. Jamie, we're the Jets. Jamie, Ellen, Tom, Susan. I don't know if that was on purpose, but we always had people sleeping over, and next door neighbors' kids would come to the house. And we had exchange students, you know, from Africa and South America live at our house and things. So they were very, very open to it. And cool. The only thing that my dad wanted is he didn't want me to tow behind a car, because he was on the side. He was reading the Ground Skimmer magazine, it was called at the time. Now it's USHPA Pilot, but and he had read about the accidents there. And he goes, "Yeah, don't tow behind a car. That doesn't look smart."
Right.
That was about it. No, they let me go, and in fact, they signed the letter to from my mom, which Bill talks about in the movie. Was actually to the high school to let me go to the first national championships. Wow. And they let me out of school to go do that. And they were very supportive, the teachers I had, because I was a terrible student. I was very focused on flying stuff.
And at this point, you're going over to the Worlds. Well, okay, first, how many people were in that event? Was that that was the first Worlds, correct?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. How many people are in that one?
Probably a couple hundred.
Wow. And what would a task be like in the 74 Worlds? What were you guys trying to do?
Duration and target landing.
Okay. So it's kind of accuracy and how long you could stay up.
Yep.
How'd you do?
And it was around, you had to go around some pylons too, but that was basically it.
And you brought over a kind of a new wing, a Peregrine. Tell me about that.
We made a big jump right from Regalo type wings with a Dickinson control bar, so I can be accurate now. That's a thing going on in hang gliding. Who invented the hang glider? So I did both parts right. But we had access to early NASA wind tunnel reports. And so did Roy Haggard, by the way. He picked up on it too. There were NASA notes you could buy with the wind tunnel testing that they did of various, wing shapes. And so I designed up 100. We didn't go by sweep angle, which is the proper way to determine it aeronautically. You know, hang gliding talked about nose angle, and the original Regalos were 80 degrees and the Sky Sports gliders were 90 degrees. So I said, why fool around? So I went out to 130 degrees. We had truncated cutoff wingtips, winglets on the tips, and they weren't rudders. We knew about winglets because we had read the NASA report on Whitcomb winglets that they use nowadays on airliners and everything. Shaped aluminum ribs, a keel pocket with shape on it. It was actually quite advanced for the time. And it was right up there as a prototype, it was rather crude because I was building them ourselves. But conceptually, it was really advanced.
And was that a big eye opener for the Europeans when they saw it? Was that, did that design start taking off? Okay.
No, it didn't influence. I don't think it influenced design, but it was so different. And I was really kind of a freaky little kid with my hair down to my shoulders, and I was still young and skinny, and I got there. Ed sent me over about a week early, so I was there before anybody for the U.S. team or group got there. So it was, they got a lot of attention, let's put it that way. And there's a very nice movie about Kirsten, the first world champ, Weltmeisterschaft, Dachenfliegen, they called it. Huh. You know? And the people in Kirsten who organized the event wanted to become the sanctioning body for the world. And I don't think that went anywhere, but at one time they thought they were going to, you know, and it's a fabulous place to fly.
Yeah, it's fabulous. Are you, you sent me these awesome pictures, which will be in the show notes for the podcast when we put it up. But are you guys still flying in swing seats at this point, or are you prone?
I was flying prone, but we did both.
Okay.
And I enjoyed both. In fact, I thought I could actually fly better seated because I was more oriented. Hmm. Despite the fact that when you're prone, you can swing your body and torque the glider too, you know, kind of instead of adverse yaw, you can input proverse yaw with the inertia of your, your body. Mm.
So I, you know, from time to time, I go out and fly speed wings or, you know, single surface wings and that kind of thing. And I've flown single surface wings when it's a little bit rowdy and I'm just, I've just got a hammock harness, you know, just a webbing harness. There's no, there's no padding. There's no safety. Or, I mean, if you go in, you're going in hard. You guys flew everything like that back in the day. There was no reserves. There was no, you know, there's no security in a sense. When I fly that, even on a pretty nice day, I just feel so naked and exposed and just, ugh. Is that because of my training? And I have that history of, you know, having a pad under my butt and some, you know, in a reserve on somewhere, or is that just, were you guys all feeling that way? Were you always just feeling, oh my God, this is, I'm so naked here.
Pretty early on, I wanted someone to develop, a helmet for your butt.
Mm. Yeah.
And people actually did get spinal injuries flying seated, like, you know, a takeoff that didn't happen right.
Right. Sure.
So it was a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this, when is the, holy cow, this is really dangerous. When did that start? When did the carnage, what year approximately were you guys starting to see, wow, this is a little out of control?
Probably 76.
Okay.
That's when the Hang Glider Manufacturers Association was started. In fact, Bill Liscombe, name comes up again.
Yeah.
He was the original secretary of the USHPA, but Mike Meyer from Will's Wing, Gary Valley, Tom, and a man named Tom Price, the fella that's in Big Blue Sky with the test rig. There was a van where we were doing testing on top. He's also the guy that said, yeah, I was this Northrop trained aeronautical engineer and these punks, you know, Haggard and Pagini, you know, we're doing all this stuff. He was really, he personally, in fact, Tom Price was probably the impetus behind getting it together, because there's no structural testing prior to that that I know of, really. It's certainly no aerodynamic testing. And so those people were giants in the creation of any kind of safety in the sport, those people I just mentioned.
You keep talking about, you know, you're kind of a punk kid, but were you, are you a trained engineer, or you went to school for engineering?
No, I went right out of high school, right into Sky Sports at age 18. My dad wanted me to go to engineering school, and I had several offers, you know, to go as well along the way, but I was already doing exactly what I wanted to. I couldn't go there to really take a course on aerodynamics for hang gliders, and I just went. And he had told me, you know, very nicely, hey, if you change your mind, whatever, and you can make it without going to college. I kind of wondered about it myself. It's like 4 years out of your life where you're not doing what you want to do. Mm. You got to study a bunch of stuff you're not really interested in. Yeah, go for it. He was very cool about it.
So you've just learned it from the trade, just being interested and being
involved. Well, Mike Murkowski, Ed Vickery. Mike Murkowski was an aeronautical engineer. Yeah, I first worked with him. Ed Vickery was a mechanical engineer. I worked under Tom Price, who's an aeronautical engineer, Bob Keeler, who's an aeronautical engineer, Jim Reuter, who's an aeronautical engineer. So I was kind of like an expert tech and a designer. And then later on in life, you know, I had engineers that were working in the team I was leading, or I hired some engineers too. So I was mostly a designer. And the one advantage was that I was also the test pilot. So we could cut through the nonsense. I could get the feedback immediately between what we were doing and the product development. And that's carried on till, you know, just recently. The hands-on stuff helps a lot too.
And then was it 76 then when you guys started making turning circles and getting tall?
No, at the first National Hang Gliding Championships, I had never thermaled at all, and had barely gone off. I think I had gone off Pat's Peak in a couple of places back here, you know, 600-800 foot hills, and I went right from there to Sylmar. And at that time, certain people flew big enough gliders, had flown enough. You know, Bob Wills and his gang in particular, and Pat Canary, I mentioned him before, and several others were already taking off from the lower hill at Sylmar and going up, going to the back.
So that's, you know, 73. Wow.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm sure those are the first people really doing it. And then also during the Andy Greenspring's National Championships, Taras Kaseniuk, who was in the movie, he was a very early hero of hang gliding. That'd be another person for you to interview if you really want to, you know, get to it. He's interviewed quite a bit when Anthony Matthews thing.
Icarus 1 and the Icarus 2.
Well, the Icarus, and then the Icarus 5
was
a super rigid wing that he built. Most of us are floundering around, you know, like doing a couple circles and thermals and trying to stay up. And he came and did a demonstration flight, wearing jodhpurs and World War I type flying goggles and a leather helmet. And he just looked so cool. He took off and set his Icarus 5 up and just went, just dotted out completely and left us mortals behind. And
we're like,
everybody standing there with their mouth open, and then came and, you know, didn't land on the spot, but darn near landed on the spot in the landing area too. So he was way ahead.
Wow.
But we were thermal, and I came back from that contest. And the second flight, you wanted me to tell some stories, you said.
Yes, please.
We flew off of, we had a group fly in. We were invited to go to Mount Washington, which, you know, everyone in the world supposedly knows that they recorded the highest, you know, wind on Earth, and it's the gnarliest mountain, you know,
that's
in New England.
Big wave flying, right? That's where they fly.
Yes, exactly. They have wave camps. Yeah. Right. You know, it's the biggest mountain in the world in New England, if you will. and so we went up there, and a whole bunch of us, and the weather was right. We were invited to come up, and the way you would get up the front side, they fly the back side now, but we flew the front side and on the west side, and landed in the parking lot. And the way you got up Mount Washington at that time was a cog railway that was powered by a coal steam train. And a couple of people had flown off. It was dead air up there, which is highly unusual. And we were flying, like I said, the west side. And my glider from, this was in 74, my glider from the Lilienthal event in May of 1974 hadn't got back from California yet. And so I borrowed my friend Greg Rector's, my original hang gliding buddy, standard Sky Sports Lark, but I did have my Vario, and I brought it with me, and I flew off, was gliding down, and I saw the steam train come up, and there's this big plume going up, and I thought, that looks like a thermal. So I went and flew over to it, and literally it was a thermal. Either it created a thermal, was a thermal, which I doubt, or it was the trigger for a thermal.
Yeah.
You know, a big trigger on a pretty stable day. And I did my first real climb, you know, and there were cinders flying around the sail and stuff from the steam train. And I remember seeing back at launch Terry Sweeney jumping up and down. He was so excited to see it. And my friend Greg was down in the LZ with a little monocle watching me go around and around. But it was really the first time anybody had done a thermal climb in a hang glider on the East Coast.
Wow.
So that was just a gas, you know.
I bet.
And that really happened. There was an article in Ground Skimmer magazine about it, and I have witnesses. I know it sounds crazy, but it really did happen. and the article, and who's the guy who does the artwork in Yushpa magazine? Does those cartoons, like?
Well, Dennis does. Does he do the drawings?
No.
Too?
He did an article with. And it had me with my chin, you know, prominent in the. Sorry, I don't remember his name. So it was called Fossil Fuel Flying, was the article.
That's great. Fantastic. Have you been
Dave Martin. Sorry, the artist is Dave Martin. Boomer and Vario or something like that.
Have you been a part? I'm going way forward now. We'll come back. But have you been a part of the whole, you know, flying off the. I don't know if it's Mount Washington where they're doing it, but they're flying to the coast, you know, the cosmonauts, some of Caliph's students and some of that crew. Oh,
well, you mean Andrei Kuznetsov from EarthQuest.
Yeah, I call him a cosmonaut.
Kuznetsov means iron worker in Russian, by the way.
Okay.
He and Max Kuchuro,
yep,
part of the Russian mafia of paragliding back here. No, I haven't done that yet.
You got it.
But I was there. I think I was there that day. But
cool. We'll get into your paragliding in the crossover in a little bit. But a lot of wins start racking up in these years. What have you got? 30 something comp wins. So where's
36?
36. Yeah. Was comps? You know, you go off to the worlds. Was this just a? I got to do more of this. Were you kind of hooked right off the bat?
In the beginning, there were contests that were more like be-ins, really.
Right.
You know, 36 wins in some professional, but mostly not, you know, mostly not. We had contests at Mittersill, at ski areas, Mittersill and Cranmore and other. But I also, you know, participated in some world, some national championships in other countries as well. The Masters was the biggest one, but I had a big advantage. First of all, I had better gliders and was professional.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the people that showed up, they didn't know how to fly.
Really?
Did not know how to fly. They're, you know, peeing themselves on launch because they've never been up here so far, and landing downwind into the parking areas and into the trees and don't know the first thing about flying. So it wasn't that tough. Basically, knowing how to fly, you're in the top three.
when you're sitting around with a new group of people and they ask you about, you know, flying in the 70s, what's a common story? What's one of the ones that kind of pops into your mind that, well, there was this one day?
I was in Africa, South Africa in 1976, and we're traveling between Johannesburg and Durban. It rained a bunch, and we're in this landscape of just wildflowers, as far as the eye can see, black dirt you could push your hand down into. I'm sure you've been to places like that around the world, too. And we're up flying on a hill, soaring, and a like a golden eagle came by and started doing loops right near us. Didn't attack us. He was kind of playing or showing dominance or something. But that's something that sticks out. But there's been so much over the times, over the years. And the people is the best part, too.
Yeah.
We're so fortunate with the people that we meet through this this sport.
A bunch of characters, isn't it? Yeah, a bunch of
weirdos. They're fantastic compared to the, you know, normal earthlings.
Yes. Yeah. That's a, it's yeah. a pretty amazing community. But one of the reasons we're talking is that Hugh Miller at XC Mag sent me a quote of yours. I've got it written down here. I just love this. I'd love for you to just
I know what I'm going to say.
Yeah. In comparison, the rest of my life has been a disappointment.
Oh, no, that's interesting. That's interesting. I didn't think that's what he said. That when he contacted me, it was because in the movie, I said it was bound to bring out the curious and the kooky. I didn't invent that. That came from a Fire Sign Theater record. It was a Procter and Bergman, a comedy team there on the radio out in California. They had a bunch of stuff like that. But back to that. Well, I guess at that time I felt that way. I think my life since that point has really improved so much. I have a fabulous life partner and wife. That's just her name's Natasha, and she's just great.
Mm. Is she a pilot?
No. Mm. No. Zero interest in that.
Yeah,
man, we're just like chalk and cheese as far as that. But, you know, I'll credit her with saving my life. I'd still be alive, but I wouldn't have a life. There's a difference. The paragliding thing has just been fantastic for me, too.
Mm, interesting.
It's been a rebirth. And even more recently, what I found out is I really miss the camaraderie of being in that type of group. And we had that in hang gliding at the beginning, that people were just really artistic and crazy and wonderful. Giving and sharing, the whole HGMA, the whole industry getting together and solving the problem of stability and structures and safety, and John Lake creating the hang system, which, you know, is the basis of the licensing and all of it. In fact, I was in the position when the FAA was looking at regulating sport pilot when that started. They said, well, what about hang gliding? Went, nope, wait a second. I was on the committee, you know, the Aviation Rules Advisory Committee. No, that's well taken care of. They have the hang rating system. They have the HGMA. They have all this stuff covered. They have insurance. They have all, you just leave them alone. They're good. I said, oh, okay, next, you know, kind of thing. So I was the mole for the sport at the right place in Washington. At that time, the only thing they did go into, which was really fair, is there was no standard at the time, at least in the United States. The DHV probably did have it, for tandem hang gliding harnesses. And they said, no, you got to have that if you're going to take the, you know, unwitting public up in the air. But I digress. The thing with paragliding now, it reminds me an awful lot of hang gliding in the beginning. That everybody gets together in the LZ, you know, we share the ride in the van up, or most often in New England, we all hike up together. And so there's time for the camaraderie and the sharing of all of it. And I miss that. And I really have gotten that back now, which I personally just love. I love all the people that I fly with.
Why did that go away in hang gliding? Was that just the way the sport went? It just less and less people doing it all the time?
It didn't. I went away from hang gliding, getting into the ultralight business, and then eventually the, you know, light sport aircraft aviation business. So I don't. It wasn't in compare. You know, it was a personal statement. I was overrepresented in that movie, anyways. The only reason that he really chose me for so much of it is that I was a kid at the time, so I remember a lot of it, and I'm alive. You hang out long enough, you're bound to get famous, right?
Let's talk about that carnage a little bit. He does a really good job in the film of talking about that, and you know, there were some names Anthony Matthews. There were some other names in the film that, you know, the, of course, the Wills brothers, you know, that I think were a big hit to the community, not just here in the States, but the world. But this was happening all over. You know, there's the same stories in Europe and in Australia and everywhere that it's, that hang gliding is happening. It was there a point where for you personally, it was just, okay, this is too much? Or did it drive you away from it at any point? Or was it just part of what you had to put up with?
It never pushed me away to the point where I was going to stop, but it bothered me greatly. Bob Wills was like Zeus, to us mortals. He embodied it. You know, he's this big guy and really strong and intuitive and likable and nice
and good
and the best by far.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you know, of course, he bought it under a helicopter doing a Jeep commercial. So you could say, well, I'm not doing that. But another quote of mine in the movie is that the sport was getting a bad reputation, rightfully deserved, because aviation, I think I said, aviation itself is exciting enough on its own without equipment failure. And that was my vote for, you know, how great the HGMA was.
Yeah. There's also an interesting thing in the film that I wrote down here that I wanted to ask you about. The reason a lot of people did it is they thought it was safe. This is interesting to me because, you know, obviously now with the passage of time, no one gets into free flight and is told that it's safe. I think newbies and novice pilots are certainly not completely aware because they're not around the carnage. So certainly that you guys were, but so I think there is some, you know, kind of willful ignorance, but yeah, just comment on that. Was it?
Well, that's a quote from Ken DeRussy, and I never thought it was safe. What could you possibly think is safe about doing that?
So you guys, those of you who are in it, were not thinking,
you know,
this,
man,
was safe.
If you want to be safe, don't get out of bed. Nothing's safe. Taking a shower isn't safe. You know, flying an airliner is safe. Driving to the airport is not safe.
Right.
Riding a bicycle isn't safe. Life is not safe. And also, getting over the fact that everybody goes away, everybody's on the big list, that's part of freedom, I think, from all the nonsense with the cults. I won't go any further.
Fair enough. Tom, tell me about the crossover. So a few years back, you know, I don't know if I have my timing right here, but 5 or 6 years back, you start flying paragliders. You know, what I heard a lot when I was getting into the sport is, you know, or when I'd come across hang gliders, that kind of thing, you know, their whole thing with, oh, well, those things collapse. And our, you know, and our fear of hang gliders is, yeah, but you're going really fast. You need a big place to land. You know, so there's these two kind of competing, I wouldn't want to do that. You know, for paragliders, it's, I don't want to set those up. I want to be able to put it on my back. There's, you know, there's lots of advantages to having something you can just have in a small backpack and walk up the hill, but they do collapse. They are, you know, for hangy, somebody who's been in the sport as long as you have, was there some real trepidation getting into paragliding, or were you pretty excited?
Jeff Nicolay, who has been a constant theme, in my life since high school. I knew him in high school. His daughter Gigi is a hang glider pilot now and is managing Morningside along with Mike Holmes up in New Hampshire, which is the best training hill in New England, or one of the best training hills in New England. He had gotten into paragliding quite early on, and he had me fly him early on, and I thought, these are kind of goofy, but they're cool. And in fact, I had my son, Jeff, he'd done a tandem, and I had solo flown and stuff. So I always thought they're pretty neat. And in fact, Dan Pointer, a name that I brought up before, who was a writer and did the original paramanual, he knew of Dave Barish, who had done some of the very early, he called it slope soaring. And did you know of him? He was the first person really to make a high aspect ratio cloth wing to fly off of a ski slope. And it was in the Catskills in the 60s.
Wow.
It was before, he didn't have a Jaybird parafoil, you know, the classic parafoil was designed by Dominique Jaybird.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't one of those. It was kind of a three-lobe thing. Look it up.
I think I remember a picture of that.
And actually, Dan Pointer had taken me out back right when we were starting with a thing called a Volplane, which was a Jaybird parafoil skydiving parachute. And it must have weighed, you know, 80 pounds, the whole pack or something. And it didn't really want to glide. But I think Dan Pointer might have been the person to say the term paragliding. So I've known of the idea for a long time, and I've always thought it's really cool. But for me, it was 11 years ago, and John Gallagher, a local sky god here in New England, who's been paragliding forever, and is mentor to a lot of people, and a grouchy old man mentor to all the people. He was an early hang glider pilot. He switched over very early. I met him at the 100th anniversary of Soaring. The Wright brothers went back to Kitty Hawk in 1911, and they thought gliding was so much fun that it could be a sport. And Lilienthal thought that too, by the way. John Harris, who started Kitty Hawk Kites, which is one of the first commercial operations for hang gliding in the United States, if not the world, and also big part of USHPA forever and RRG, had an event, and he invited a whole bunch of people together. And I happened to be in the house with Roy Haggard and John Gallagher and myself and several others. And so I had told John, okay, Flight Design, the company that I've worked with and who is our business, you know, we were Flight Design USA, and Flight Design, the manufacturer of those really cool carbon fiber airplanes, also was a very early brand of paragliders. And then they branched into making the first rigid wing carbon fiber hang glider called an Atos.
Yeah.
It's the same company and the same fellow, Matthias Betsch, who's an early hang glider person from Europe, from Germany. And they were manufacturing swing paragliders in Ukraine where the airplanes were manufactured. And I had said one year, in the beginning of Light Sport Aircraft, we sold a lot of airplanes. We were selling 60, 70, 80, 90 airplanes the first few years. And it was a big business. And they manufactured the paragliders there. And I had said to one of the managers, who was a paraglider pilot, you know, I've always really wanted to really get into that. I just never have. And he said, you sold 70 of these things? Hey, man, what color would you like? And so they sent me a Swing Arcus 4. It was really a nice glider. Mm-hmm. And a harness and a reserve. And I took it up to Morningside to take some lessons with Jeff Nicolay. And he was, oh, you're a hang glider pilot. You know how to do this already, practically. And of course, I went forward and wailed myself a few times. And I thought, geez, you know, I'm really not even hang gliding enough. If I take this up, I'm not going to be able to be good enough at it to really pursue it. So fast forward to, and this was 2007. So fast forward to 2011, and John Gallagher said, You own a whole paraglider kit and you don't use it? Go up to Morningside and take some lessons. And I promise you, the next time it's on at Cape Cod, man, I'll throw you off. Because, anyway. And so he did. And my first real flight in a paraglider, I think I flew for 2 hours or something. Because it was so horrible that day.
Yeah. Your first one. You must have been hooked.
It's the same kind of thing, sure. Really. You know, it's just a different vehicle. And I can actually think and fly at the same time. So it's always kind of helped. Mm. But yes, I did get hooked. And then I thought, well, yeah, these things are dangerous. But I'm just going to fly at the Cape or Mount Tom maybe when it's glass off. So, of course, that's a slippery slope. And then I really got into it and started making friends and liking it. And then I bought a Tequila 4 was my next glider, which is a really nice glider. Mm-hmm. And then now I'm flying I have a Delta that I bought used for, it was my glider for a while. And now it's my beater wing, although it's in very nice shape, and an Alpina 4. I'm really into paragliding.
Awesome. And is this, you know, 55 years of aviation and all the different stops along the way, which we've barely brushed on. Have you got any goals? Are there things you want to do with your paraglider that maybe you never did with your hang kit?
I'd really like to do some triangle flying. Mm. It's pretty hard to do. We don't get the stable conditions for it, or at least, you know, low wind conditions here in New England all that much.
So you guys are usually doing one ways, you're going downwind?
Yeah, I definitely do.
Yeah.
And I will say that between hang gliding, the hang gliding stuff, I spent a lot of time sitting out in the field, you know, waiting for other people to come and get you. And so I don't have a lot of tolerance for that. Mm. But I do love the flying. In fact, I recently, you know, we sold our company 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. And I work as a consultant now for several companies, but not a lot, like 10, 20 hours a month, which is perfect. And people asked, including Natasha, said, "So what are you going to do when you're retired?" I'm going to go paragliding. No, no. I mean, really, you know, what are you going to do when you're retired? I'm sorry. I don't think you're listening.
I'm going
paragliding. Every time the wind is right somewhere, I'm going there. And I have since I retired, and I just love it.
That's awesome.
And, you know, going out on bike riding when it's not good for paragliding. And I love it. And it makes me feel like a kid again, too. And it's really motivating me to get in better shape. And I've always kind of put some effort into it anyways. But I love it. Mm.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's really nice to see that you've still got all the passion after all this time.
As much, maybe a little more. Really? I don't know. I really love it.
Wow.
And we've toyed with the idea of moving to southern Spain, because Natasha really loves Spain, and the flying is great there.
Yeah,
all year round.
Yeah, a little more reliable as well than in the Northeast, I think.
Northeast isn't that great. It's good, but you have to drive a lot. It's always blowing some way somewhere, but you know.
Have you been out in the Northeast your whole life?
Well, I was based here my whole life, but I did spend a lot of time in Chattanooga, off season, to train in Chattanooga, if we call it training back then, hanging out flying and doing development work. And then I spent a lot of time in Southern California doing development work out of Torrey Pines, some with Tom Price at Albatross Sales, who was the fellow that helped start the HGMA, and he was both a Northrop, he was a trained aeronautical engineer and a sailmaker. You know, so he was uniquely qualified. Hmm. And I worked with him. He was great.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. Two questions. Answer them however you, in whatever order you want. When you think back of all the flying you've done, what's your favorite flight? And tell us all about it. And then also, what's the craziest thing you've ever seen in flight?
Some of the real memorable stuff from the beginning was being at the Canadian National Championships up in the Rockies there. And
would that have been Golden?
Kootenai Bay. Mm. Kootenai Bay.
Kootenai Bay. Oh,
Kootenai
okay.
Bay up there.
Yeah.
That's where they had it. Cool. And that was just so different. And I got on my little Volkswagen bus, you know, drove to Montreal, took a left turn, and ended up out there with my glider on the roof. And then I was, after I won the Masters Championships in 1977, I was flying for Bill Bennett's Delta Wing Kites. And Bill Bennett, Rich Piccarelli, who was a very early person in skydiving, base jumping, and hang gliding. And with Roy Haggard, Bill Bennett, and Rich Piccarelli, they developed the reserve parachute too, by the way. And we all went to Rio together because we had won, and we brought a bunch of gliders. And then we went to Mendoza, Argentina for the Argentine National Championships. And being down there was just really special. And then also after the World Championships, I drove around Europe for 6 weeks with Mike Harker, who was, I guess, the first TV program that was broadcast, pan-European TV broadcast, was a sports show. And Mike Harker, one of their first, or, you know, one of the first episodes on it, Mike Harker, this young, brave American serviceman living in Garmisch, flew a hang glider off the Zugspitze, you know, and it was on TV. So he became instantly famous all over Europe. He was a very handsome guy and was looked like a model, like a, you know, classic Marlboro man model with a period mustache, you know, and he drove an American van. And like I said in the Naked Pilot interview thing, I rode around with him going back and forth between Austria, Germany, and like Corvara, Italy, and the Dolomites in his van. And we were smuggling T-shirts from Italy through to Germany, and gliders from Germany to, you know, Austria and Italy. And that was awfully special, too. We were supposedly the first people who flew off from behind Neuschwanstein Castle, too.
Wow.
He was first, and I think I was second.
Wow.
And that was real special, too. And that's right when I saw my first windsurfers out on a lake that was out in front of there, too.
Oh, wow.
Same trip. Yeah. But I don't know. Sorry, a whole bunch of stuff.
That's all good.
My last flight was my favorite, you know.
Because it's the only one we can remember at this stage with so many. But
it's good.
Tom, thanks so much, man. I appreciate you sharing your just a fraction of your history. We could talk for hours about more and more of it. But
yeah, we'll catch up sometime.
We'll catch up and we'll hopefully do some flying together. Maybe you can come out to one of our events out here in Utah this fall.
I would love to.
And be a part of that community. It's pretty outrageous.
I would love to do that. I would love to do that. I've not got a lot of experience with big air yet. So,
well, this is no time like the present, my friend.
Okay.
Let's do it. And there's good triangles out here. We fly some good triangles.
Excellent.
Tom, thanks, man. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
If you find the Cloud-Based Mayhem valuable, you can support it in a lot of different ways. You can give us a rating on iTunes or Stitcher or however you get your podcast. That goes a long ways and helps spread the word. You can blog about it on your own website or share it on social media. You can talk about it on the way up to launch with your pilot friends. I know a lot of interesting conversations have happened that way. And of course, you can support us financially. This show does take a lot of time, a lot of editing, a lot of storage and music and all kinds of behind the scenes cost. So if you can support us financially, all we've ever asked for is a buck a show. And you can do that through a one-time donation through PayPal, or you can set up a subscription service that charges you for each show that comes out. We put a new show out every 2 weeks, so For example, if you did $1 a show and every 2 weeks, it'd be about $25 a year. So way cheaper than a magazine subscription, and it makes all of this possible. I do not want to fund this show with advertising or sponsors. We get asked about that pretty frequently, but for a whole bunch of different reasons, which I've said many times on the show, I don't want to do that. I don't like having that stuff at the front of the show. And I also want you to know that these are authentic conversations with real people, and these are just our opinions, but our opinions are not being skewed by sponsors or advertising dollars. I think that's a pretty toxic business model. So I hope you dig that. You can support us. If you go to cloudbasemayhem.com, you can find the places to support. You can do it through patreon.com/cloudbasemayhem. If you want a recurring subscription, you can also do that directly through the website. We've tried to make it really easy, and that will give you access to all the bonus material, little video casts that we do, and extra little nuggets that we find in conversations that don't make it into the main show, but we feel like you should hear. We don't put any of that behind a paywall. If you can't afford to support us, then just let me know and I'll set you up with an account. Of course, that'll be lifetime, and hopefully you're being in a position someday to be able to support us. But you'll find all that on the website. All of you who have supported us or even joined our newsletter or bought Cloud-Based Mayhem merchandise, t-shirts or hats or anything, you should be all set up. You should have an account and you should be able to access all that bonus material now. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate your support, and we'll see you on the next show. Thank you.